You are listening to National Security Law Today.
Hey, listeners, and welcome back to National Security Law Today. Last week, we began our conversation with Mark Mills, founder and executive director of the National Center for Energy Analytics, to explore why America's mining and processing infrastructure has fallen behind and what that means for the future of battery technology. This week, it's all about energy needs and how fast they're growing. Alisa and Mark dive into the demands of data centers, whether current stockpile efforts are enough to support future defense systems, and why hydrocarbon-based energy is still poised to dominate for decades to come. As always, thanks for tuning in, and here's Alisa.
I want to pivot here for a minute because I know you think a lot about data centers. I know you've written a book on cloud, but you talked about our predictions about what's going to happen in terms of our energy. What are we looking at in terms of what our energy consumption is going to look like? Quantify it in any mathematical way that you want. You know, I won't call in 10 years and say, here's what you said.
I've written a lot about this for decades. And because I have, people do hold my feet to the fire. Data centers themselves are like skyscrapers. They're as big as skyscrapers in square feet. They cost as much as skyscrapers to build, but we build 10 times more of them a year than we do skyscrapers. They use 100 times more energy per square foot than a skyscraper. 100 times more energy per square foot. The square footage of data centers we're building now would be as if we took the commercial building space and built 20 times more commercial buildings a year, as they already are being built all across the country. The single largest new source of energy use in the Western world. This is unsubsidized, unstimulated infrastructure. This is not being built because the government says we need it. It's being built because the things it provides, people want to use and businesses are using. It's not just that the information infrastructure is a physical hardware infrastructure that's energy using. So software exists in hardware. The fact that software is energy consuming is sort of shocking to people. Everything you do in the digital ecosphere consumes energy. The explosive interest to build AI data centers is because AI is useful not just for fake videos, it's useful for all kinds of things, including warfighting, in particular for security and cybersecurity. That demand pull is what's created the need to build a facility, which has created the energy need, which has got everybody shocked, just shocked. There's electric demand coming from all this stuff.
And water demand. Even a Google search, what is every 100 Google searches is a liter of water?
Sure, because all energy ends up as heat. This is a physics lesson going back to high school. And you have to cool everything. You have to use water to make the computer chips. Can you operate them with water cooling? And increasingly, you have to use water cooling to cool the chips themselves because they run so hot, they're so powerful and so fast. But this is an industry with almost infinitely deep pockets. They have a lot of money. So the good news about their water use and power use is that finally, an industry that's energy consuming at scales that are sort of unprecedented, that also has incredibly deep pockets. The big seven collectively have about $1 trillion in cash. They can spend money to look for technology solutions to the water problem, the cooling problem. I mean, all the things that we worry about. This is a microcosmic view of my philosophy on environment. If you're wealthy, you can make the environment cleaner and safer. It takes wealth because you have to use wealth to deploy the technologies. They're wealthy.
They're looking at nuclear again, as we're tracking, right? Seems like the obvious one, although it's obviously got its risks. But I do think I understand, you correct me if I'm wrong on this, I did not realize how much nuclear material could actually be recycled. It's something in the order of 70%, maybe higher.
You're referring to the what's called nuclear waste. So on the reactor.
But France does do that. I don't know why we don't.
Why we don't? Well, you want to blame the politicians again. Specifically, you can blame President Carter for that one. The United States was on track, like France. We pioneered, it's called reprocessing, which in elementary school language is called recycling. You can recycle the uranium that comes out of a reactor. So in a nuclear power plant, is finished using up its fuel, quote unquote. There's nothing burned, nothing's changed. The fuel itself, it looks like a ceramic pellet inside of big metal tubes. When the reactor can no longer use the fuel, it's called spent. It looks exactly like it was when it went in, but about 80% of the original useful uranium is still in the fuel. You can take the fuel, melt it down, concentrate the waste to dispose of, It's a solid material, again, like a glass. And then you put the fuel back in. The United States has enough spent fuel on the surface of the operating nuclear power plants to run our reactors for another century without digging another new mine. And we could tap into that in a couple of years by simply deciding that we should have a reprocessing industry again that we pioneered. Just take all the fuel that already exists, has already been mined, recycle it, and put the waste back exactly where it came from, which is safely in big concrete casks sitting on the surface, the glass-like ceramic pellets, and put the fuel back in the reactor and keep running them for another half century. This is an elegant solution that physicists thought was a delightful solution to not have to keep mining stuff. And that was ended for political reasons in the 1970s by President Carter and never successfully revived by any subsequent president.
What informed that at the time? There's always an event, you know, that drives this kind of a policy change. Was this the Three Mile Island thing or whatever that was?
No, it predated a Three Mile Island. It was virtue signaling. So politicians are very good at virtue signaling, as you know.
Boy, are they. Yes.
So when you reprocess nuclear material, the way you make a nuclear weapon is that you put uranium into a reactor and you breed plutonium. And when you breed plutonium, you can't get to it because remember, it's all locked up. You have to reprocess to get the plutonium out. You need to know that to know what the virtue signal was. The United States wanted to send a message to the world that we wouldn't reprocess because reprocessing was a path to nuclear weapons. It's a path to making cheap nuclear fuel in perpetuity, but it's also, if you repurpose it and do totally different things, it's not the same technology, but it's the same starting point. Then you now have a path to how you could make a nuclear weapon. So in order to say, the world shouldn't do that. We don't want other people have nuclear weapons. We won't do that. We already have nuclear weapons. We had them then. We invented nuclear weapons. So the virtue signal that we wouldn't do this because it might make nuclear weapons, while we continue to make nuclear weapons, by the way, in hindsight, should have seemed stupid. I mean, there's no other word for it. I thought it was stupid at the time. I was involved in the industry at the time. But, you know, those of us who defended it lost the battle. The Russians, by the way, reprocess, just like the French. The South Africans reprocess. Reprocess means recycle the unused portion of uranium back into the reactor.
So The virtue signaling thing, I hear you loud and clear. Both sides do it. It's tedious. But what is the waste concern? And I'm not talking about nuclear waste. What is the concern about doing that? Is there a safety concern? Some sort of toxins are released. What is it about that? Yeah. Does it take some sort of big, heavy machinery? Is it like building a fab?
It's very chemically intense. It's a big industry.
Dirty.
It's dirty by definition. But that's true of all of our industries. They do everything that exists in life. There are no products that exist in your life that didn't start by being dug up from a mine and using chemicals to dissolve the rocks to make everything you like. When it comes to spent nuclear fuel, you take the ceramic-like fuel, which is a solid. So the waste is a physical solid. You dissolve it and you separate out the useful uranium and make it back into a glass, put it back in a reactor. And you take the waste, which is the radioactive, the stuff that is harmful, dangerous, you don't want it in the environment, and put it back into a glass form. And you isolate it from people. When it's in glass or ceramic form, it can't melt, it can't explode, it can't leak, it can't go anywhere, but it's radioactive. It's very dangerous for humans to be near it. So you store it in shielded concrete and steel canisters on a place where people can't get irradiated and hurt. It can't contaminate the groundwater or the air because it's not a liquid or a gas. So you end up getting smaller quantities of waste to manage because remember, you're taking most of the material physically is not waste. It's the uranium you want to put in the reactor. Small amount of its waste, you store it. And ultimately, the idea is you bury it deep underground so you know nobody can get near it. But you can't get near it anyway. The quantities are tiny. If you got all your electricity from nuclear energy, you personally, the quantity of waste for you over your whole lifetime from that would be not as big as a coffee cup. That would be your personal allocation. There's nothing else that makes such tiny quantities of waste. Problem is, it's radioactive, so you have to keep people away from it. So that's the scary part. But that's not hard to do because it's tiny quantities. Batteries are different. Batteries don't have remaining useful fuel. Batteries, when they're used up as an electrochemical engine, like any other worn out machine, when it's worn out, is not useful. But what's left of the machine are of its constituent components, it's copper, it's nickel, right, steel, manganese. There's stuff in it that's still useful that you could, in theory, because all things in theory can be recycled. The only issue is it's always about money. Is the process needed to recycle the battery yield you materials that are cheaper than, same price as, or more expensive than getting the native raw virgin materials from the mine. In 90% of the cases for metals, the exceptions are aluminum and gold and lead. They're really easy. And steel. But all the critical metals, the rare things, turn out they're really annoying to recycle. They're really expensive to recycle. So what will probably happen is a combination of two things. We just throw it out because it's too expensive to recycle. Or we pass laws, and back to my pen, that says you have to recycle it and you just absorb the cost. You say, I just declare that it's wasteful to throw that thing out, even though it costs more, not less, to get the metals through the recycling process. I simply declare that I don't want to, for other reasons, political, social, or virtue signaling. But you could be perfectly reasonable. Say, I don't want to dig up a net new ton of rock in Africa or in Arizona. So I would rather recycle, even though that costs more.
Let's move back to national security for a second. Sort of the kinetic aspect of warfare, we're watching it change right now in the Ukraine conflict. You know, we've seen these Iranian-made drones being used by the Russians, and I'm sure they're pretty good because they reverse engineered one of ours. Systems within systems on all of these drones are obviously going to require batteries, and a lot of them. So what do you think is the policy concern on the horizon with respect to that? Because if we're still dependent on China, we're still dependent on Russia for these things, how are we going to even defend ourselves and create this next gen of weapons that is not human operated, except from a ground a thousand miles away?
There's two big parts what you're asking. One is the use of critical metals and minerals in weapons systems themselves. Right. Separately, the kinds of weapon systems we have, drones, increasingly autonomous weapons, or at least smart weapons. I was on the team that built what was probably termed the first smart weapon. The first guided missile against tanks was the Hellfire missile. I was on the team that designed it. I designed the detector for the first one. So smart weapons are pretty new. The first smart weapon use in warfighting was Gulf War I. And we learned, and the Russians learned what I knew because I was in the design team, they are astonishingly effective. So smart weapons are, everyone knows now that this is the future, and including autonomy increasingly, which is a different challenge. Setting aside the velocity of change in the weapon systems themselves, the kinds of metals and materials you need, the quantities for that are identical to you need for everything else in civilian life, computing, batteries for cars, for Teslas, for your smartphone. Same technologies, just repurposed. But the quantities you need are tiny. Starting in the early 1920s, the idea of a strategic metal reserve for critical minerals for weapon systems has been around for a long time. That is effective enough, by the way, for the quantities of metals and minerals needed for weapon systems. Where we get into trouble is when we try to make that quantity of metals needed to operate civilian and commercial systems. Or put simplistically, we can supply all the batteries we need for weapon systems. The challenge is making enough batteries to run all the cars, let's say, or put lots on the grids. That's where we can't stockpile enough. It's impossible. We can't mine enough. We can mine enough for our strategic needs for weapons purposes, even with very small, rapid deployed mines. We can do that. These are all possible and already happening to some extent. It's when we're putting ourselves in economic strategic risk by depending on China for commercial uses of these metals at scale. It does put us at strategic risk if we don't stockpile or have alternative sources for our military. The DoD complex may have a lot of flaws and faults, but this in this particular area, it's in, at least in my experience, is not one of them.
So you're saying that they do consider and have stockpiles?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. And, okay. And the real problem is stressing those systems by demanding too much into the civilian markets is what is pushing the supply chains into China and Africa. Because we need them at scale and low cost. We get them at low cost by going to fragile economies, kleptocratic economies, subsidized economies, which give us cheap metal temporarily because we're closing a blind eye to moral risks, environmental risks, and geopolitical risks in order to get cheap stuff at scale for commercial purposes. I think it's a bad trade. I've argued it's a bad trade for a decade. And now a lot of people think it's a bad trade, but it's a different trade. It's a geopolitical risk, but it doesn't put at risk our ability to build night vision goggles on our own drones, not in any significant way. What it will put at risk is if we, for example, don't let data centers get built at scale we like to stimulate our economy, because that's you know, our military is supported by a robust economy. So the linkage here are the soft linkages, these indirect linkages, as opposed to the one you referred to as, will we have enough metals to make the batteries that we need for missiles and the military radios? Yeah, yes, we'll have.
No, we do regularly say that our national security depends on the economy. There's no question about that. Yeah. You know, unquestionably, there are things about the economy that don't work in any administration, but a loss of a tax base is very serious. Rounding out our conversation just now, I thought it might be interesting to note for anybody who reads a financial news in the Wall Street Journal, tracks Bloomberg or Financial Times, let me just give you a sample. And this is just, I think, within the last 16 hours of news that's hit. One is copper will hit 12,000 this year. We need copper, right? Yep. So that's the prediction. Yep. And in order to run anything that would process any of this stuff, including smelters, we still need fossil fuels. And I pointed this out to you before we got started, but what the heck's going on with Gazprom? Because if you read, it doesn't seem to be doing as well as you would expect it to be doing at this moment. But it says its business model's been destroyed.
Well, it has. I mean, their old business model was selling cheap gas by pipeline to Europe, Germany. So that business model ended with
which denuclear, right? They decommissioned all their nuclear plants.
Right. And well, they're burning more coal. That's what they decided to do. And they're burning more of our gas, which is a good trade, I guess, for us. But our gas shipped in by LNG is more expensive than Gazprom gas because pipelines are cheaper to move gas. So that business model is being changed to LNG and shipping gas to China across the Trans-Siberian pipeline. So those two things take time. So Gazprom has to go through a readjustment into the direction of its product flow, the pipes going east to China, which China likes. It's a good trade for China. And more gas going to LNG, which the world buys anyway. We claim we're sanctioning it. It's a very leaky system, which we're not enforcing and haven't enforced. Gazprom has got an adjustment to go through. But at the macro side, the Russian economy's receipts, you know, 70% of its export revenue, oil and gas, Russia. And that's still pretty much the case. And their absolute level of income from oil and gas exports is not materially different than before the Ukraine war. It's a little lower, but it's not profoundly lower because, again, it's a leaky system. And also the people who are buying it, Pakistan, India, China, are not party to the sanctions. And they're happy to take discounted fuel. So they're losing some money on discounts, that is Russia, and the counterparties are gaining. The point you made earlier that all the refining requires fossil fuels, coal, oil, and gas. Yes. Put differently, everything that you use, every service, not some, every product, all of it, 100% of it requires oil. Oil has touched everything. So 80% of the world's energy is provided by hydrocarbons, oil, gas, and coal at the sort of primary level. But 100% of all goods, products, and services require use of oil. Most of it requires use of coal. So the world runs on hydrocarbons, full stop. There's a lot more of the other stuff being built, wind and solar, mostly through subsidies, but also because technology got better, but mostly stimulated by subsidies. And collectively, just as a calibration point, all of the world's solar panels and wind turbines combined, all of them combined, supply is half as much energy to the world as burning wood does still. Wood burning globally is more than double the energy supply to the world than all the wind turbines and solar panels combined. The anchor of the world that's propelling it is oil, gas, and coal. It hasn't changed in the last two decades when the Western world has spent $19 to $20 trillion to avoid using oil, gas, and coal. All three are up over those 20 years. They rose last year. They're going to rise this year. They're going to rise next year, no matter how much money is spent. It's because of the physical chemistry, the economic and physics of the engineering of systems, how we can make everything from steel and aluminum to how we make fertilizer, deliver food. All of it is anchored in hydrocarbons. If we think that's not true politically in this country, I guarantee you the Chinese don't think that's not true. And the Russians don't think that's not true. And OPEC and Qatar, Kuwait and Iran, they all know what I said is true because it's just in the data. And if they're the ones that supply the marginal fuel to the world, that has profound geopolitical and strategic implications. If we're now the largest producer and have been for quite a while now. We could substantially increase our production and exports to become the dominant in every possible sense, you know, geopolitical, economic supplier of energy to the world. That has strategic implications. I mean, set aside all the other stuff that are in people's hands. If you think about the strategic implications of the shift of balance of power, if we're not in that game, if we're a consumer or just not even playing at all, it wouldn't change what the world's doing. The world's using a lot more of that stuff. And the political implications of that are non-trivial. And I think we're still living in a fantasy about what is actually happening and the consequences of what's actually happening in this realignment of sort of the energy geopolitics of the world.
Well, I mean, I hope, too, that there can be some new technology. I think it was the hottest year on record this past 12 months, and that's going to generate additional energy needs energy use. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I just don't presently see an end to the cycle, but I do hear occasionally people say, well, there will be something that will save us from this cycle. I'm just not sure what it is or what would ever scale, but it is alarming. And I do think it's affecting things in the United States and will ultimately affect the tech space because I think it's influencing young people's decision about whether or not to even have children.
If you believe that we're going to face challenges from weather being more extreme, climate, droughts, then the answer to that problem is technology of resilience and adaptation, which requires money. No matter what the magic wand and claims and clickbait about breakthrough in X or Y, fusion around the corner, none of that matters because none of those things exist commercially. None of them can scale quickly, even if they existed. They're proven to be viable. It takes decades and decades for civilization to shift to energy systems at scale. The bipartisan center of this is wealth and resilience, which is, by the way, the center of civilization for 10,000 years. You drive wealth, create resilience and systems so society can tolerate disruptions, whether they're economic or weather or pestilences and all these things. This requires wealth and technology, which is why I wrote my book. My book is a fundamentally optimistic book. The reason the subtitle is A Roaring 2020s is because we are at a pivot point in history, which is rather unique technologically, and it hasn't been this significant in a century. I'm comfortable predicting in the coming decade or two, this is why I call it the Roaring 2020s, it's going to extend to the 30s, a restoration of productivity growth to what we had in the early half of the 20th century, which would add $20 to $30 trillion of net new capital to the U.S. economy with productivity growth again. And that money is what you need to do all the things that people worry about, from healthcare to building schools and roads, engineering plants that can take higher temperatures or less water or more water. That all comes from wealth, all of it.
All right. Well, that's all we have time for tonight. Thank you so much for joining us, Mark. And we hope that you'll come back and talk to us again in the future.
Thank you.
And our guest tonight has been Mark Mills. He's the founder and executive director of the National Center for Energy Analytics. We will hyperlink to Mark's most recent book in the notes to the cast. And thank you for listening to NSLT. Be sure to give our cast a rating on your listening app of choice. That does trigger the algorithm. It helps us continue to provide you cost-free, thoughtful, long-term podcasts on interesting topics relevant to the national security law, and policy. Remember, if you're lawyers out there, to hear other people's points of view. It will refine your skills as an attorney. It'll make you better. One of the features of our national security is our unity in a country more diverse, not just in ethnicity or race, but also in thought than any other country. Our producer, writer, and host is me, Elisa Poteet. Yes, I'm always here in my individual capacity and no other. My other co-producer is Francis Burkham of Ohio. And my other co-producer is the ever, ever wonderful Holly McMahon, who we cannot see right now because she's invisible. but she is amazing. She is magic. And she's almost as magic as all the collected members of the Standing Committee on Law and National Security, without whom this podcast would not be possible. So we'll see you next time. Feel free to send us comments. You can always reach us by email. And you can find us at nationalsecurity@americanbar.org.
The views expressed on National Security Law Today have not been approved by the House of Delegates or the Board of Governors of the American Bar Association, and this recording should not be construed as representing ABA policy.